So, welcome to Brunchworks Episode 3, a podcast about design thinking and making change happen. We are Ryan Cole
and Mary Doucet,
and we want to help you use the power of human-centered design to empower you with creative confidence. Whether you're creating an iPhone app or an educational process, we're all creators, and there are tools and processes that we can all use to inform our work. Design thinking is one of the most powerful. On the last episode, we explored the empathy stage. We also talked to user research expert Ming Li. Today, we'll see what to do with your understanding of user needs and how to define problems worth solving.
Yeah, great. So let's start talking about problems, or maybe like how problems and solutions are linked kind of intimately. We were just talking about the different ways that engineers and designers have to see problems. For an engineer, it's quite straightforward most of the time. Like, let's make this bridge longer, let's make this car faster, this thing lighter, or this cheaper. And then there's commonly one or two solutions which needs to be right, and all the rest is just wrong and we have to forget about
it. Right. And unfortunately in design, I don't think we typically have that clear cut of a problem. Typically we'll be faced with a situation create a process which achieves such and such goal, or even something as vague as end world hunger.
Yeah, and then we try to leave some room for creativity, of course, and for innovation. And so as you talk about ending world hunger, I think this is linked also to wicked problems. Maybe you've heard this expression before. So there are kinds of problems where you don't see any obvious solution. You feel stuck. It's so big, so impressive that we think, okay, this can never be solved. But like me and Ryan, we think that it's possible to solve thanks to design. And even if it's just a small step, there is a chance. And this, I would like to talk more about problems like as a word. I don't really like this word of problem. I find that it's really negative. So sometimes it is, yes. Sometimes you're facing something horrible and you need to make it better. But sometimes it's more about finding some opportunity to make people's life maybe more comfortable, more emotional, or using different experiences. Yeah. Do you think that something needs to be broken before we fix it? Like.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I think it depends also on what you consider broken. Because I think a lot of people tend to approach the world with an attitude of that's the way it is and that's the way it's always been, and why bother trying to improve something?
Yeah.
But if you look at history, most of the largest, most disruptive innovations have been addressing a problem that people didn't even know that they had yet.
Absolutely, yeah. And this is linked to the idea of unexpressed need, that the people might want something or feel that there is something not perfect in the way they live, but they don't know how to say it. So in the research, we've tried to dig into those feelings, this emotion, stories, and so on. And now we would like to use those in order to define a problem or opportunity.
Right. And I think, sort of as a side note, I think this second stage in the design process is really probably one of the least utilized stages. Just from my personal background, I have sort of a traditional graphic design education. And typically graphic design, as a design discipline, you don't tend to dwell too much on framing the problem, because generally it's a relatively straightforward problem. You could actually, you know, even though it's a creative design discipline, you could actually kind of think of it more as this, what you said about engineers, how engineers frame a problem.
Yeah.
Because it's typically, you know what the outcome is going to be. You know that it's going to be a corporate identity system or a book. So you don't really have to think too much about, what are we actually creating?
Yeah. I mean, you could frame a brief or this point of view and say, I like to make a campaign with 10 posters and one video. Yeah. I was like, okay, I will do it. And
right.
I'm used to it. I know
right,
what is
right.
it. But you could also say, okay, let's inspire people to read more books.
Right.
Or
right. With possibly the same outcome, but possibly not.
Absolutely.
Right.
And this leaves us more room for imagination.
Right, right.
You know?
And I think this is also like a tricky step, because there's this element of design actually in creating this problem. like creating this problem brief.
That even the brief has to be designed. That it starts much earlier than what we usually think. We say, okay, the client will give us a brief, and then we propose some design. But actually, the brief itself should already be a subject of investigation.
Right. You know? Right, and I think it's this. I think often in graphic design specifically, this is kind of a stage which separates. You know, like a good designer or design studio from a really amazing one is that, you know, typically you'll get a project which has a defined brief already.
Yes.
And it's really simple to say like, okay, cool, we're making a website, let's make a website, and then jump right into, you know, picking colors and playing with layouts
sure,
and stuff.
Sure, making bigger buttons,
right.
And getting more traffic in, or this kind of stuff.
Right, and never really, you know, zooming out that one level and saying like, actually, is a website the best tool to accomplish this job? Like, what is
why
the thing,
are we doing it?
What
why?
Is the thing you're trying to do with this tool? So,
yes. So this brings us to what characterizes a good problem or a good good brief. Yeah. So I think the first point is obviously that it needs to be related to user stories, to all this user research we did before. It shouldn't come just out of thin air. Like, not thin air.
Yeah,
it's very thin. That's very difficult. Thin air. That it needs to have some reality to it, some like thickness or flesh.
Right. So yeah, and I think that's where this user research stage really comes in super handy. And you know, you talked briefly earlier about this discovering unknown user.
Needs.
But it really ties directly with this thing that Ming said about you know, never ask someone what they want.
Yeah.
Because you'll get this like, you know, we want 3 posters and a banner ad.
Because they will ask, they will answer what they think that you want, that you are expecting.
Right.
And that's why you need to dig deeper and use your intuition, maybe.
And aim at the problem rather than the outcome.
Yes. And so this good problem or this good brief should be related to user stories, but also be wide enough to be motivating, to be inspiring. So that when all throughout the project, we can go back to it and say, okay, does this make sense? Why we are doing this? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it should be narrow enough so that we don't get lost.
And could you give an example of like an inspiring problem brief?
Good question. I would say, for example, today, like, people are always looking at their screen all the time. You look in the street and they are just looking at their phone, iPads, or listening to some music. We could say, how might we help pedestrians in the city to pay more attention to one another than to their own devices? And as an insight, I would say so that they create meaningful connections, for example.
Mm-hmm. Right. So instead of saying simply, like, how can we get people to use their phones less?
Yes.
Framing it in a way that you're sort of aiming at the positive outcome of this.
Or, like, instead of saying, how can I make an app that tells people to switch off their phone and talk with their neighbors? Yeah? Maybe in the end, the product or the service will be an app. But maybe it will be something totally different.
Right.
And I try to not close it too much so that I can get more ideas.
Right. You had an interesting experience. Yesterday, we were actually at the American Embassy filing for my youngest son's passport. And if you've ever been in an American Embassy, you know what I'm talking about. But they have metal detectors and they have the mirrors looking under the cars. And you have to leave all of your electronic devices at the desk. And so in this waiting room, there's probably 25 people waiting for, you know, talking with a clerk or whatever. And it was really amazing because actually I thought it was kind of unusual that, like, you know, there was so much kind of interaction taking place between all of these people. You know, people were talking with strangers and, like, laughing. And then I suddenly realized that no one had their phones with them.
They had to leave it in the lockers, yeah.
Because otherwise, you know, in a waiting room, everyone would have had their nose in their phone and, you know, whatever. But because they didn't have that, they were actually engaging with each other.
Yeah, that's a great example.
Funny side effect of sort of draconian security in the American Embassy.
Yes. So we come to this point where it's like how to actually write a good problem, how to define it. Yeah, we could also call it point of view or the statement of intent. What are we trying to achieve through this project? Yeah, one way I like to use is to formulate it as a "how might we" question. So this is from IDEO, and it can be in the form of a Mad Lib, this kind of game where you fill in the blanks. And the sentence would have this form. So how might we help the user, which we have defined, to achieve something because or despite some context or constraint, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how might we help perfect strangers to interact in a meeting room despite high security measures,
right?
For example,
right, yeah. Right, and it's funny. You know, me and Marie were putting together the show notes for this, and this sort of comes from Marie's background of product design and this kind of more specific design thinking. Whereas I said before, my background is more kind of traditional graphic design and UX and interface design, and I realized that this question, this sort of Mad Lib way of structuring a problem is almost identical to what you do in this agile software development. So in software development, you call them user stories, and it's basically a way of taking a complex goal, so, you know, creating this complex piece of software which has all of these different features, and sort of like breaking them up into little atomic bits, which clearly define like one thing that a user is trying to achieve. So, and it's almost exactly the same form. It's as a user, I would like to function because value. So it's almost exactly the same kind of structure.
For example, as a librarian, I would like to be able to look to search for books by publication year.
Right.
Or as a young person, I would like to be able to make mobile payments in a safe way.
Right. Right. And so, by framing it this way, you're sort of decoupling it from any sort of implementation. You know, so you're not saying we need a search functionality where we can sort by publication year.
Yeah, so the question is open enough. It doesn't already imply some technological solution.
Exactly. Yes. And I think that's the key in this stage is defining a problem narrow enough that it's actionable, but still allowing that freedom of creativity and freedom of stumbling upon something unexpected, mm-hmm. like in the result.
Yeah, absolutely.
So really treating it as specifying the problem and not already specifying the answer.
And I think in this, when you're defining the problem, maybe you don't find the right problem straight ahead. And again, there is not like one right problem, one right answer. But I would say that problem can be designed too. It can be also prototyped. And the best way to prototype it is just to get some post-its, markers, and write one idea, one problem on each post-it. Put them on the wall, share it with your team, and then see what really wakes you up, what is
right.
Like exciting you.
Right. So again, to treat this process of defining the problem as part of the design process already.
Yes.
And even to put it into this kind of iteration cycle of, you know, writing something, getting feedback on it, rewriting it, and trying something.
Absolutely. And one way to select which problems you're going to work, because you might get lots of ideas, but at some point you need to make some choices.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's important that you also define some criterias. Which will help you to prioritize those jobs or those goals that you have for your customer, and at the same time, your own goals, yeah, for your business. So criteria could be what's the most important, what's most tangible or most feasible, yeah? What kind of needs are unsatisfied where there is like a gap in the market, and what would be most lucrative or where we can make some money.
Mm-hmm.
Another way of seeing it is about those three good design principles. Let's say the desirability, feasibility, and viability. So the how much the user would like it, the technical side and then the business side, commercial side. And of course, how does it fit to your bigger business model?
Right. Yeah,
you might come up with some idea which is totally out of your area of expertise. Can be good, but can be risky as well. So mm-hmm. you have to weigh in all that. Another technique I would recommend is to vote. To vote with stickers or with dots. that every member of your team would have a set of stickers, let's say like 10 maybe. Mm-hmm. And you make a table where you would list the different ideas and on the other axis list the different criteria. And then you can give points and say, okay, I think this is a good point. Yeah. And in the end, we see the sum and we see which idea gets more points. And we choose that way. Of course, sometimes people get influenced when they see, oh, there's more points there. So yeah, we can also imagine some more anonymous way of voting. But I think that's quite easy to implement. You're a landscape architect. You were Fulbright scholar with over 14 years experience working in the built environment. And in September 2011, you founded or co-founded Recite Festival in Prague, which is a festival that focuses on public space, waterfronts, urban mobility, and creating people-centered cities.
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, that's great. That's from your website, so I hope it's up to date. Well, could you tell us a bit about yourself? Like, you seem to be a very multifaceted man with many interests. Like, what? How do you say? Like, how do you describe what you do?
I don't know that I'm multifaceted, but I try to be. And I don't know exactly where that comes from. I've tried to identify why. For example, I come from a relatively conservative Irish-American family. We're first generation Irish-Americans. And, you know, we grew up in this environment. I was born in the center of New York City at, like, most middle-class families in the 1970s and 80s. We moved into the suburbs and became sort of... So I have this sort of hybrid, like... this dense Manhattanite countered by this guy that grew up in basically surrounded by trees.
Mm-hmm.
So at a very young age, I was interested in construction. I used to build stuff all the time. And like at the age of like probably 6, I knew I wanted to be in the construction field somehow. So like I drew a picture of a construction worker in second grade when we were asked to do what we wanted to do when we grew up. And my teacher was like, well, maybe you want to be like an engineer or an architect. And I said like, okay, like, you know, whatever. That's just like a kind of a funny story, but it actually was kind of true. I really wanted to be involved in building things. So I always did that. You know, when I was younger, I was always in construction and design fields, and I sort of worked my way through a training, which was, it's pretty diverse. Like I ended up getting a bachelor's in history and business. And then I went back to school to study landscape architecture for my master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of a transition in itself. I always wanted to be an architect. In fact, I liked buildings. But as I got older, I liked the environment. And I started to focus more on cities and how people are interacting in cities and realized that it wasn't really the buildings that were making cities. It was the places in between the buildings that made the cities. And that's really what sort of matters, and it mattered to me. So I combine these interests of building, sort of environmental upbringing, and then found landscape architecture, which allowed me to work sort of at the intersection of these things to create a built environment for people. But have been fortunate enough to be involved in projects around the world. You know, I worked in something like 15 countries and really large urban development projects, and mostly on the urban waterfront.
Oh,
and
mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the waterfront work is really exciting. It's always at the edge of the city, and I think the edge of the city is where like the most exciting things happen, ecologically, culturally, and also sometimes economically. So I've been involved in those types of projects. And then somehow found myself in the middle of the recession in New York. Like, all my friends had lost their jobs. Our architecture firm went from like 25 people to 3.
Were one of the lucky ones. Yeah.
Yeah, I was like holding on to my desk for dear life. And just like serendipitously, I was invited to teach at ČVUT, which is, of course, the Technical University in Prague. Because, I mean, at that time, I was sort of, you know, we were working on some really great projects as a young designer just out of graduate school in 2007. You know, I was like thrown into these amazing projects, what I thought were amazing, which was like in Dubai, China, Mexico, and then great projects in New York. And there were these really like complex, fancy projects. And it's kind of fun as a young designer to work on that stuff. But during the recession, when all those clients went bankrupt and, you know, all my friends were losing their jobs, I sort of took a second look and was just trying to figure out what exactly I liked. And again, like coincidentally, I was asked to teach at the university. So I applied for Fulbright, was fortunate enough to win, and spent a year, almost a year in Prague, again, trying to identify what it was that I really liked about this, and then also what I could teach people, and specifically students, about my time in practice and about my theories of cities and landscape architecture. So that's essentially how I came to know Prague. It was, you know, I sort of arrived not knowing anyone except for the person who invited me to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And I left this kind of, you know, a relatively prolific career, you know, in a short period of time, and was totally shocked, you know, like when I got to Prague, I knew nobody. I immediately found out that instead, you know, I came from this environment where I was working like 80 hours per week in New York, to an environment where I was only expected to teach 8 hours per week at the university. So I somehow had a whole lot of time on my hands. And quickly became bored. So within the first few weeks, I decided that I need to do something about to tell people about what I was doing and on my practice, and to try to identify or design the problem that exists in Prague and then in other Central European cities. So I was essentially trying to figure out what exactly the problems were relative to cities, urban planning, urbanism, and architecture in Central and Eastern Europe, specifically in Prague. And I found that, you know, some of the issues that you were dealing with, I had some information about how to solve, or at least how to address, and, you know, realized that, like, all cities have the same problems. You know, people are very quick to say, like, you know, you can't apply that here because it's from New York or London or, you know, mm-hmm. Mexico City. But in fact, like, all these places, big and small, have the same urban problems. So that was, like, one of the first things I tried to address, is, like, how to sort of communicate that there are international solutions that could be applied and manipulated for smaller cities or cities in different regions in Central Europe, because I found a lot of resistance when I started talking about international work.
And you think this resistance was like, what did it came from? Like, is it really because they were too conservative, or because they thought it was crazy, or like, or because of money? I don't know.
I'm not really sure, and I should kind of clarify. I mean, I met a great group of people in the first, you know, month or so that I was in Prague, you know, from like Regina Lokotova at the brand new school, private school of architecture at that time called Arkeep.
Yes.
I met Adam Gebrian, who of course is the architecture critic, Igor Kovasova, and Yvette Yokosura. Sorry, I always forget Yvette's last name.
Yeah, and there's Regina as well.
Yeah, yes. But I met a great group of people, and then, of course, the professor that invited me, Professor Hansen, and, you know, they were sort of really encouraging that they had someone in Prague that had, you know, had built and designed internationally, and it was able to talk about landscape architecture and urbanism with a sort of different, with some different ideas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was immediately encouraged by this group of people who was kind of working on these things, but, you know, it seemed like needed a little bit of help, you know, to at least spread the message and raise awareness. But then once you got outside of that sort of group of innovators, you know, I think there's a resistance to international ideas, specifically in the Czech Republic. And I can't really identify that because I'm not Czech, you know, and I'm off, you know, I think it's problematic, and it's problematic from a number of different perspectives. And the one I was particularly interested in at that time was educationally, like, why are architects not being trained to deal with the built environment? You know, outside of the technicalities of like designing windows or, mm-hmm. you know, doors, yeah. or, you know, really technical kind of technocratic architecture. That was, you know, kind of afraid to look outside the boundaries of neo-functionalism.
Right. So basically, I mean, you know, separate from the fact that this was in Czech Republic, I mean, that's basically like this whole cultural level or layer, which sits on top of design in all contexts, really.
I think so, yeah.
You know, nice. So, you know, if you separated this from architecture completely and, you know, recontextualize it to be kind of like a situation where a consultant is coming into a company with new ideas, you know, there's also a company culture which could potentially prove an obstacle to new ideas and new thinking.
And when you say to go beyond the like technology in education of architecture, maybe you could think like what is beyond the technology? Maybe talk a bit about people-centered cities, like what...
And just to address the previous issue too, yeah, it absolutely goes beyond architecture. And I've the more I've been involved and the more kind of the more Resite is done and the bigger topics that we address, I'm finding that in almost every topic. For example, this year we're addressing, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but we're addressing the intersection of the shared economy and design and city making. And, you know, when you start to look at the collaborative economy or the sharing economy, it hasn't really taken hold in Central and Eastern Europe and in the Czech Republic, who's like kind of an economic powerhouse relative to the rest of the countries in the region.
Yes.
Which is kind of shocking. So, you know, we're doing a little bit of research and I'm commissioning a paper on the sharing economy in this region, and there's really not a whole lot there to research.
Right.
So, you know, it's the same thing, whereas like the sharing economy, collaborative economy has been sort of exploding in other parts of the world, specifically in the US and Western Europe. Whereas it's just sort of being discussed in the Czech Republic. So yeah, it sort of spans across different different disciplines.
Right.
And it's certainly relative to all types of businesses, I
think. Right.
That's something I was wondering that you, in your festival or series of conferences, you make urban design nice and you're trying to raise awareness. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering... what's next and if it has really repercussions on the reality.
Sure. Yeah, no, I think there's absolutely hope, otherwise we probably wouldn't be doing anything.
Good.
And there's always hope, right? There's always the possibility to change. It's just finding the right people to change with and making the right arguments, I think, is really important. Coherent, kind of clear and simple arguments for people to understand. That's definitely worth doing. And what the next step is, well, you know, there's always a next step. Like, you know, we're at this year's festival, if I can just jump to the topic, the topic of this year's festival is the shared city. And as I mentioned, it's sort of dealing with the intersection of technology, open data, design, and urban development.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to sort of wrap all this stuff into a coherent conference. And we deal with lots of topics because that's what the city is about. You know, that's what business is about. It's about dealing with sort of all the different players and all the different themes that constitute that city or constitute that area of economics or architecture or whatever. So, you know, we deal with this kind of big issue all focused on making a city that's A, more modern and sort of competitive with the modern world, and B, you know, most importantly, more livable. It's
mm-hmm.
about people.
Sure.
You know, we really want design that's about people first, which means it's not about kind of cars or kind of mega developments that aren't really paying attention to the public realm.
Right.
But we really want a city that's sort of designed around people. So it has like, it's safe for people to walk. It's safe. It's a safe environment for children. There's bike lanes. There's not only more parks, but higher quality parks within, let's say, a 10-minute walk of everyone's home and business. These are the things that are important to us.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's absolutely a next step because, you know, as I talked, I was talking to some people last week, some fairly like important people in the Czech Republic, about the advantage of being Prague. It's unbelievably convenient to be living in Prague. It's probably one of the most beautiful cities in the world. It's located geographically in the center of Europe, and it's pretty easy to get to. So all those things combined sort of point to what's going on and where the future might be, and the future I think is really positive with that respect, because the people are really interesting in the Czech Republic. It's a very highly educated workforce.
Right.
It's a people that sort of love the environment. So you've got like a lot of really interesting things going on for it. It's just that
right.
we need to take advantage of those things.
I think it's this kind of cultural blockage where I think people specifically here are kind of really used to accepting things which suck.
Yeah.
You know, and there's I mean, I think this, you know, me and Marie are teachers, and we're teaching people who are basically, you know, 21 years old right now. And these people have a really different outlook than people who are even, you know, my age, like 30 and above. So it's, you know, they're much more quick to question authority. They're much faster to work around things than I think previous generations. So I think that's something which...
It's really positive.
Yeah. Right, right. Just which, you know, kind of naturally and evolutionarily will play out in the next 10, 15 years. So,
And when you, I mean, I like that you talked in the beginning about that you're interested into the places in between the buildings and not the building themselves.
Right.
And designing for people, designing with data and so on. There's a lot of talk about collaboration in urban planning, like consulting the inhabitants and... how do you think, like in a practical way, how we can involve more the citizens into the design of their city?
This is an interesting question because we talk a lot, you know, about social innovation really reaching the bottom, you know, bottom of citizens. And I don't say bottom sounds like a bad word, but we talk about top down, bottom up planning, which really means like good leadership from the top. With good ideas and strong activism from the bottom, which mm-hmm. means citizen-led movements and active citizens. So I think, you know, relative to social innovation, there's been like many different changes and many different evolutions of participation in design or participatory design for cities over the last 30 or 40 years. Mm-hmm. You know, like these kind of things are important. And I think one step for the future is really what we're tackling this year, which is about utilizing open data and utilizing sort of the power of technology and apps to get people around and to get people active. Because especially in the Czech Republic, I think it's important that people don't have to physically sort of be involved. You know, people can can use their mobile phone or their computer and sort of join a movement or get active within an app or something. So we're doing a thing called Prog Hacks, which is the kind of first and of course the biggest hackathon relative to open data, using open data to make better applications for citizen involvement and to solve other urban problems like making the municipality and their processes more efficient.
What kind of data are you planning to use and who is going to take part into this Prog Hacks?
We're using a lot of data from demographic data from the city of Prague, from Institute of Planning and Development, who's kind of won some awards for their open data initiatives, at least mm-hmm. in the Czech Republic. And we're using some Vodafone data, some mobile data that Vodafone is providing via their foundation. Of course, all anonymous data.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is to get this, to sort it, and to create the applications. And the outcome actually will be... Investors, so there'll be investors investing in the winning apps. So there will be real projects coming out of this, and it's being run in collaboration with Startup Yard, who's a really active kind of player in this kind of new economy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The types of people that are involved are mostly these participants are mostly programmers and designers, kind of user experience designers.
Yeah. Right.
So the UX people and the data and programming people. Are mostly those, and then you know there's going to be some young companies there, some startups there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it sort of encompasses basically what's happening in the larger economy elsewhere with young people starting new companies to focus on real problems.
Right.
It would be probably nice to have also representatives of other groups and just programmers, like not just from the technological part, but maybe also from social. Mm-hmm. side and just normal users, let's
say.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, and I think that's always been our plan for all of our projects and all of our kind of workshops and things, is to get a broad demographic of people, and we've always done that. Like mm-hmm. our conferences, for example, attract like you know almost 15-20% social scientists, but we're focusing on urban planning and architecture, so. You know, that's kind of an indication of the kind of demographics we like to reach. It's, you know, anywhere from the economist to the social sociologist to anthropologist to architects and then, of course, investors and politicians.
Right.
And business people. We really want young business people to get around mm-hmm. our projects.
And do you see this, like, you know, Prague Hacks, like, do you see this as, like, a really valuable kind of tool for, in a way, like, crowdsourcing this, you know, defining the problem and coming up with solutions for this, this really, like, as you said, super complex problem of designing a city?
Yeah, I think so. And it's so new. I mean, even in sort of Western circles, you know, we haven't really figured out how to use open data yet. We're, you know, the first open data 1.0 is kind of like, okay, it's open data. Who's providing it? What kind of data it is? In the end, the data was pretty shitty. It was like, you know, no one could really utilize it for anything.
Right.
But because it was too complex to understand and to mine. But I think in what's in the advantageous position that we're in right now in Prague is that, you know, in the rest of the world is open data kind of 2.0. You know, what's the next step in open data? How do we utilize it better? And that's where we're starting from in Prague. So okay. It's sort of like, you know, we can almost redefine how data is being used and offered, I think, now, because it's sort of people are just getting excited about it and okay. There'll be fresh ideas. So I think it's a really important moment for us
right.
and this kind of project in this region.
And have you guys solved any like specific problems with that technique, or is it kind of still too early to say?
I think it's too early to say, unfortunately. I mean, the project launches on June 12th. It's a two-day workshop or hackathon until June 14th. And then we'll be presenting ideas at Recite Conference on June 18th and 19th.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be talking about those ideas throughout the festival, which really happens from the 12th to the 19th.
Okay.
Yeah. So
yeah. So I think it's a really important transition moment for the Czech Republic and for Prague, because you know we're dealing with these issues for the first time and we're trying to relate them to city making, which has really not been done. This is the first conference in the world that focuses on the intersection of open data, the sharing economy, and design for cities.
Right. Yeah. So you've been talking like pretty generally about like. You know, designing public space and sort of approaching these problems. So how do you go from this really kind of broad approach to a really large problem? And how do you narrow that down and select kind of single specific problems to solve?
Well, I think that's in collaboration. I mean, I'm a huge collaborator. I really, it's sort of the mission of the organization, and I try to talk about it in both my kind of design practice and also in Recite. And we, you know, in terms of like the specific problems for Czech Republic or those that we focus on at the conference, we put together kind of a broad coalition of people, what we call a program committee, and we kind of go through and discuss how we want to, you know, address certain problems. But at the same time, you know, I've been pressured a lot in the last few years, and finally the pressure is subsiding, to do a very technical conference, you know, to mm-hmm. do very technical programs. Like, you know, we have this specific problem with the Zhishkov rail yard. Let's do a conference on it. And I'm always like, no, you know, we need to do a conference about sort of a cutting edge topic
right.
that it may or may not have been discussed around the world already. Hopefully not. Like this one is fairly new for 2015. And then within that, we'll try to carve out some specific problems. And those problems, in some cases, are coming from the city. So the City Institute for City of Prague Institute for Planning and Development, IPR, they've identified several issues they want to deal with. Last year it was the airport. This year is Zhishkov rail yards. So we bring in international experts and we kind of focus specifically on those topics, but outside of the public forum
right.
For the most part.
Okay.
And in some cases we'll take that to the public forum and say, okay, yesterday we did a workshop. Here are the solutions, or here's some of the ideas. Like, what do you think? So I think, you know, it's a broad range of things. We also talk with partners. You know, like Vodafone is particularly interested in open data right now, as are we. So it was a natural partnership to sort of see what we could do with open data and how to solve, you know, some specific problems. And, you know, the process hopefully will work in that within that hackathon, the things that are addressed during the hackathon that come out, you know, from young professionals, those will be the issues that are addressed. You know, the,
right.
the winning app will be the one that sort of addresses a real problem.
That's cool. So it's like, that's almost like using a social event as a problem solving tool.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
Kind of crowdsourcing in the real world.
Yeah, we're absolutely crowdsourcing. And we're trying to sort of like live out our mission, which is about this top-down, bottom-up kind of ideas for the city.
Right.
So, you know, we work with the city to come up with some ideas to solve them on a sort of leadership and sort of large-scale kind of economics level or planning level. And then yet we're also sort of tapping young professionals to come to events,
right?
And the outcome of which will be maybe even a more important project that we've developed than the city developed, you know?
Right.
So that's the interesting thing about what we're doing.
Right.
Yeah. And for like citizens who want to start some change in their city, would you have some practical tips or something like where to start?
Well, number one is don't be afraid. I think there is never a better time for change than now, and now is always. I think, you know, getting sort of complacent with our place in history, our place in the world, is not going to help kind of advance your city, not going to help advance the competitiveness of your city. It's not going to want to make people live there. So we always need to be innovating, and I think, you know, I think we have to keep that in mind. It's easy to become complacent and just sort of say, well, you know, this is the environment I was given, so this is the environment we'll live in.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things never change that way. We look to, like, someone like Jane Jacobs, who wrote The Death and Life of American Cities, and Jane Jacobs lived in the West Village of Manhattan. If anyone's been to Manhattan, they know the West Village is this remarkable neighborhood,
right,
you know, in the world. It's a very special place, it's a very special scale. Well, Robert Moses, the planning director in New York City at the time, planning commissioner in New York City, wanted to put Westway, a highway, right through the West Village. in the 1960s. Jane Jacobs has fought back for like a decade. This kind of unknown at the time, unknown little kind of woman from the West Village who just lived in a little townhouse there, decided that this was like a travesty of American planning.
Right.
That you couldn't put a highway through the middle of New York City. It would just be a disaster for the entire city. And she was right.
Right.
I think that's a great example that you gave there, that actually you don't need to be somebody big or influential.
Or part of an institution.
You just need to have the motivation and start to do it,
yeah,
if
right,
you want some change.
So, yeah, and this year, we, you know, in 2015, Recite, the conference, and also some public events will feature, we think, one of the coolest people in the world. Who is like the modern day Jane Jacobs. His name is John Narr. He's the former mayor of Reykjavik.
Mm-hmm.
John Narr was a former punk musician, comedian, actor, creative type, who during the recession and after Iceland went bankrupt in 2008, basically decided that, well, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, was taking over the government in Iceland. And their first budgetary cut was going to be culture. They're going to cut all culture out of the budget.
Of course.
So this kind of former punk musician and comedian said, like, you know, this is crazy. But they can't be cutting all culture. So he created a party called the Best Party, and a political party. And he decided that he was going to run for mayor as a joke, just to kind of highlight the issues of how ridiculous politicians were at that time and pretty much always. So he created this Best Party. He ran for mayor. He won. And city council won, his party won city council, and he was mayor in Reykjavik for 4 years, and basically kind of campaigned as a joke, won, and then implemented all these kind of innovative policies. So, you know, it's like a modern day story of, like, if you have a voice, use it and try to come at politics or try to come at
the
city development process from a different way.
Right.
You know, it's really quite that simple.
Like,
so I think if anyone's interested in this, you have to come see John Narr. He's funny. He's smart. He's kind of an inspiration for everybody, I think
we are getting towards the end of the discussion. Maybe if there's any other projects you're passionate about, maybe from your practice or...
Well, I mean, I've got like lots of stuff I'd like to talk about, but maybe, you know, like I said, maybe we can follow up some other point. We can talk about the built work that I do, because I think a lot of the built work that I've done in the United States, Canada, Mexico, has been really influential in how we've sort of developed some of the ideas behind Recite. And then Recite just becomes kind of a theoretical extension, kind of working backwards, you know, almost like from
practical
not way. Building to building.
Right.
And in the end, like I think you asked in your questions, you know, what am I really interested in? I'm really interested in making a better city. And to do that, it means physical design and actually physically building things. But first, we have to talk about it. We have to identify the problems, and we have to design the problems. And then we can start to design solutions for them.
Right, right. Well, cool. It's been great to talk to you. So thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule and your office move day to phone into Prague. So
Yeah, we're really excited. Today we're moving out of Manhattan into Brooklyn in our new office, and it's a really exciting day for us.
Cool.
Which is actually only a 15-minute walk from my home, so it'll be a nice day.
Yeah.
You have fast access to all of the hipster ice cream places you want.
Exactly.
No, I have to say I'm getting quite excited about the conference. I was not too sure if to go or not, but now I'm really, I think I'm going to buy my ticket soon.
Oh yeah, please do. I mean, you know, one of the things, if I can say one last piece, is that ReCite is a nonprofit organization. We put on what I think is the best conference in Europe that talks about innovation in cities and design in cities, which is, of course, a very hot topic right now. And we're funded, you know, through sponsorships, but also through conference ticket sales. And it's really important. Actually, our only, like, safe source of revenue is through selling tickets to our conference.
Okay.
So, you know, we encourage everyone who's listening and anyone who's interested in their city to come check us out, support us, and hopefully we can do it again if it's successful again.
So can you tell us where the audience can find you, or what is the website or email?
Yeah, absolutely. If you Google ReCite, ReCite.cz, you'll find us, and that's our website. You can register in our conference. You can find out more information about us or our Facebook page, which is ReCite Festival.
Super.
Cool. And what about you personally? What's your studio's website?
Our studio's website is w-architecture.com.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Okay.
Great.
So
thanks, guys.
Thanks a ton. It was a great talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Ciao. Bye.
Bye-bye.